You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, or the perilous realm, or just folk stories in general. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land full of wonder, but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art, criticism, and fandom, paying attention to the ways stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, "Art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead." So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl and a big old chunk of homemade bread, and help us enrich the reading experience and have some fun too. This is our first episode of Rudyard Kipling's Just So Stories. We're going to discuss six of them today. And with me, as always, he smells like Michael Farmer, and he feels like Michael Farmer. And when I knocked him down, he kicked like Michael Farmer, but I can't see him. Is that you, Dr. Michael Farmer?
It's me. I would love to hear a tidy story about how I became the co-host of this podcast.
That would be awesome. Somebody should write that. Well, here we are. I didn't say the six that we're covering in the intro there, but they are How the Whale Got His Throat, How the Camel Got His Hump, How the Rhinoceros Got His Skin, How the Leopard Got His Spots, The Elephant's Child, and The Sing Song of Old Man Kangaroo.
Yep, and they are the first six of 12, so this will be a two-part series, so we won't be doing this for a year and a half like we were doing the Grimm's Fairy Tales.
Yeah.
So it'll be nice to have one that goes a little faster and where we're not reading 100 pages each time.
That's right. Yes. Although my daughter said to me, she said, "But there's so many you didn't talk about yet." And I said, "Yeah, we didn't want to talk about all of them." And she said, but what do your fans say?"
I think she might be our fan, Josh.
I know. It's true.
I feel like I hear more from her than from anybody else. I mean, I only hear from her secondhand. I should make that clear. Yeah. She's not writing me letters or anything.
She probably happily would if I let her know your address.
Well, would you like me to summarize the how the whale got his throat and we can start talking about that?
Yeah. Jump on in.
Once upon a time. Oh, you know, before we do this, we should probably give the backstory behind the Just So stories, because unlike Grimm's Fairy Tales and unlike some of the other things we'll read eventually on this podcast, the Just So stories are written by one guy, and we know when and where and how and why he wrote him. Which is that they were told as bedtime stories to his daughter, Effie. And she insisted, so the story goes, that they be told in exactly the same way every time, which is why they're called Just So stories, because they have to be told just so for them to work on getting Effie to go to bed.
Yeah, it's they definitely feel like they are written for, you know, for a particular child. And I guess maybe we'll get more into that as we read, but.
Yeah. And when so much of the great children's fiction of the 19th century was written for one particular child. I'm thinking of like the Alice stories by Lewis Carroll, mm-hmm. or Alice Lytle, whatever. Her name is Alice. Mm-hmm. And then like, Winnie the Willows by Kenneth Graham. Those are written for his son, who is the model for Mr. Toad. So, like, I do think that's a very typical thing of 19th century children's fiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so How the Whale Got His Throat. Once upon a time, the whale ate fish, and he ate lots and lots of fish because he was so big. And in fact, he ate so much fish that the only fish left in the sea was the little stutefish. And the little stutefish decided to trick the whale into not eating him. So he gives the whale the longitudinal and latitudinal coordinates, 50 north, 40 west, where he can find a shipwrecked mariner who, while he is a man, as Kipling writes over and over again, a man of infinite resource and sagacity, nevertheless, he would be a very good meal for the whale. And so the whale rushes to latitude 50, longitude 40 west, as fast as he can. And there he finds this shipwrecked mariner who is wearing a pair of blue canvas breeches, a pair of suspenders. And you can't, Josh, you definitely cannot forget the suspenders.
Cannot forget them.
And then also a jackknife, which is that like a switchblade? I'm not sure what a jackknife is.
I didn't look it up.
Anyway. So anyway, he finds the man there, and he swallows the man down. He swallows the man and his raft and his clothes and his suspenders, which, of course, you shouldn't forget, all the way down. But the mariner, as the astute fish has pointed out, is a man of infinite resource and sagacity. And so he figures out a way to get the whale to vomit him out, which is that he jumps around as much as he can inside the whale until the whale gets the hiccups. And the whale essentially begs him to leave him. And he says, well, no, I'm not going to leave unless you drop me off at the place of my specification. So he basically gets the whale. He tricks the whale into taking him home. And then the whale takes him home, which I guess is Dover, the White Cliffs at the southern part of England. And he spits him out. But before the man goes out, he takes the raft he's been riding on, and he takes the suspenders that we weren't supposed to forget about, and he ties them together and makes a grill and just shoves them into the back of the whale's throat. And that's why the whale only eats plankton now, or only eats very small fishes. And meanwhile, the astute fish goes and hides in the mud at the equator so that if the whale tracks him down, he won't be able to find him and be angry at him. And that is the story of how the whale got his throat.
It's a good story. It's got some elements in there of, you know, a little bit of Jonah, a little bit of Pinocchio, maybe. I forgot to look. I meant to look. Is Pinocchio
this
predate
is after,
this?
Or this is after this is, Pinocchio.
This is, yeah, okay. So some of those familiar elements in there.
And then it also has, as I think all the ones we looked at today, some of the ones in the second half of the book aren't like this, but it has the format of a myth, but a very particular kind of myth, the kind of myth that explains why things are one way instead of another way, right? And so most of these stories, not all of them, but most of these stories are going to be stories about how various body parts on animals came to look the way they look. And often, as we'll find, it's because the animal crossed a man, and the man the man made him pay for it. And that's exactly what's happened. That's exactly what's happened here.
Right. It is the age of men.
Right.
At the time that he's writing. So it makes sense. That particular type of myth, I think it's interesting what he's doing with it, you know, the way that he's kind of creating these new versions that are, you know, just as ridiculous as the old versions, I guess. You know, it's kind of hard to tell exactly what are these parodies, or is he just, you know, is he honoring them in some way, or is it a little of both?
Wouldn't you love to hear the tone of voice that he read them to Effie in? Like, I feel like, he must have been at least somewhat silly, right? Like, he must have been doing silly voices and stuff, because even the narrator says these kind of cutesy little things that let you know that maybe the story shouldn't be taken super seriously. Even the fact that he calls him the astute fish, which I take to be a shortening of astute.
Yeah.
Like it's a smart fish. Like even that, he's putting on this kind of patois to tell the story to Effie, who he calls throughout best beloved, which is very sweet.
It is very sweet. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's definitely a silliness here. And I think that's one of my favorite modern storytellers is Mo Willems. He does the you may know him from the Don't Let the Pigeon series.
Pigeons driving the bus.
Yes, yeah. And also he has a series of books about Elephant and Piggy that are really hilarious. But he talks about this a lot in his kind of philosophy of storytelling and writing for children and stuff, is he's trying to create an environment where parents are allowed to be silly with their kids, because he sees a dearth of that, I guess, in the world, you know, and feels like our world is hurting because of it. And so it's better when adults are allowed to be silly with children and children are allowed to see the adults being silly. And I feel like Mr. Kipling would go along with that.
Have you ever read any other Kipling?
I did read the Jungle Book many, many years ago. It may have been at the time when we were talking about it for the podcast, or it may have even actually been before that. I can't remember, but I have read the original Jungle Book at some point.
I haven't read that, and I haven't read his novel Kim, which I think is supposed to be his best, and I haven't read any of his poems. But in my head, like, he's this stiff upper lip British guy. I picture him, I guess, kind of as the Colonel Hothie from the Jungle Book, from the Disney film The Jungle
Book.
Absolutely,
yeah.
This kind of no nonsense walrus mustachioed imperial Brit, and So like it's a little bit disorienting even in these stories to see him, you know, figuratively doing silly voices and just being silly, because that's not, you know, out of my ignorance, that's not what I associate with Rudyard Kipling.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I have a kind of thesis statement for these stories, that, or not just for these stories, but just for like art in general. And this isn't entirely original to me, but I've pieced it together from so many places. I couldn't tell you where I got it all from. But the artist is always creating kind of for three people at the same time, like three inner people. Like you always have your inner child that you're trying to care for and nurture your inner child, and also not disappoint your inner child. So there's something that perhaps you needed or wished you had as a child, and so you give that to your child through the creation of your art. And then the second person is kind of your I guess for most people it would be like an adolescent version of themselves, but it's kind of like whenever your taste comes on board, you know, your personal taste, you're creating for that person, and you're hoping to create in such a way that you're not that you're impressing that second person that you're kind of creating for. And then the third person is, of course, your future self, or the self that you're hoping to become. And you're creating in such a way that hopefully is moving you a little down the road towards that person that you're becoming. And so I feel like what you said is exactly the kind of impression that I have him of also. And I don't know if that's just because that's all I have in my head is this kind of stereotypical, you know, stiff upper lip British guy. But I do feel like there's a little bit of that in here. Like perhaps he needed a little more silliness in his own life as a child. I think he had a hard childhood. And then, obviously he's writing for his own child, but I just feel like there's maybe a little bit of that in there. But then all the morals are kind of pushing you towards that stiff upper lip. Like the moral of this one, you know, is some sort of complete self-reliance and, you know, being able to, you know, whatever the situation that happens to be swallowing you up, that your own tenacity will get you out of it.
Right. You know? Yeah. It's very much like the well-qualified adventurer or something like that.
Yeah. And I feel like that comes across in all of these, that moral is, if not the person that he is, maybe at least the person that he's aspiring to be, you know.
You got to write an essay about that, Josh. That's a very interesting theory.
Well, thank you. Like I said, I've pieced it together from many places, and I couldn't cite my sources anymore, so I don't know if I should write an essay or not.
Synthesis is the closest thing to creation.
Oh, there you go. That's very good. So yeah, but I think the criticism I would have of the story is that I don't buy that, like, kind of self-made independent person. You know, like, I don't quite buy the moral, you know. But
if this guy's such a genius, how did he get stranded in the middle of the ocean to begin with?
that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, like, what vision. I'm so hung up on the kind of quasi-evolutionary mechanisms in these stories that I didn't really think about, like, what kind of vision of human flourishing is going to emerge from them. And you're right. I mean, it's going to be the late 19th century stiff upper lip imperial virtue, right? I'm sure, because that's who Kipling is.
Yeah, and that's who he's writing for. In some sense. I mean, obviously, like we talked about, the story is specifically for his child, but then once he publishes it, that's, you know, that's his readers.
Right, and I mean, that's what he wants his children to be.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Effie died quite young, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I saw that. I did a little back. I did very, very minimal background research, but I did see that he had lost his daughter. So. Yeah. So. Anyway.
Do you want to talk briefly? Does your edition have the pictures?
It does. Yes.
And Kipling illustrated these himself.
Yes.
And, you know, they are fine.
The captions are amazing. Does yours have the captions?
Yeah. Here is the whale looking for the little stutefish who is hiding under the door sills of the equator. The little stutefish's name was Pingle. He is hiding among the roots of the big seaweed that grows in front of the doors of the equator. I have drawn the doors of the equator. They are shut. They are always kept shut because a door ought always to be kept shut. The ropey thing right across is the equator itself. And the things that look like rocks are the two giants, Moar and Coar, that keep the equator in order. It reads like a child's explanation of a drawing he's done, right? Like when you talk to a kid who's drawn something that you can't tell what it is, they give you a very elaborate explanation.
Yes. Yeah. And I wonder what the collaboration process was between these and his daughter. Like, if he showed them to her and kind of had her, you know, like, what's that ropey thing, Dad? You know, because it's so perfect. I mean, it may have been all out of his head. He may have just had the talent to do that, but it's just so perfectly childlike. In all of them, there's something like that where it's like the ropey thing, the things that look like rocks, you know, that kind of language. It's just, it's in all the captions, and it's very funny. But you're right. The illustrations themselves are fine. I mean, I don't know, but I'm not really an art critic. So
that's okay. Cause he's not really an artist. I mean, they're better than I could do.
For sure. Better than I could do too, I think.
And I read that later editions are illustrated by somebody else, I assume a professional illustrator. And I think that would really be losing something. I think the kind of amateurish quality of the illustrations really makes them a lot more fun. Because again, this is supposed to be something he is telling his daughter to help her go to sleep.
Right. Yeah. My version has both, actually. It has the drawings, and then it also has color illustrations by another guy named Joseph M. Gleason. And I agree, like, having them side by side, the color illustrations are just, they're completely different. It's a completely different tone, you know? So, yeah, I'm not sure who decided that an illustrated book, illustrated by the author particularly, needs its own other illustrations, but I don't know. I guess it's nice to see other people's interpretations of things.
I hope Gleason enjoyed the money he made from it.
All right. Should we talk about how the camel got his hump?
Yeah, I like this one a lot.
Yeah, this one's pretty good. So this all happens back in the beginning of the years when the world was so new and all, and the animals were just beginning to work for man. And so there's a camel, and he is just most excruciating idle, it says. And then there's a horse and a dog and an ox. And so the man asks all of them to come and do their work for him. And the camel refuses, but the other three go off and do their work. And so then at the end of the day, the man calls them all together and says, I'm really sorry about this, but that fella out in the desert who's most excruciating idle, he's not going to do any work. So you guys are all going to have to work that much harder. And so they're very angry about this, understandably. And so they get together and they have a little powwow, and they try to convince the camel that he needs to join them. But, you know, every time anybody talks to the camel, whether it's the man or these animals, he just says, "Humph," and walks away. So what they do is they call up a djinn of all the deserts. And they ask, is it right that anybody should be idle? And the djinn says, well, no, of course not. You know, the world's so new and all, and there's so much to be done. And so they complain about the camel to the djinn, and the djinn says, well, I'll take care of it. So the djinn goes over to the camel, and he says, what's this I hear of your doing no work with the world so new and all? And the camel just says, humph, to him as well. And he says, you know, you've given the other ones extra work, and this isn't fair. And the camel again just says, humph. And the djinn says, I wouldn't say that again if I were you. But of course, the camel does say it again, and he says, humph. And so the djinn, he creates a humph out of using magic, and he places it onto the camel's back. And he tells him, because you missed those 3 early days, now you're going to be able to work for 3 days without eating because you have this hump. And he says, don't ever say I never did anything for you. And then he says, go out of the desert and take care, you know, behave yourself. And so the camel humped, and he's never yet learned how to behave, but he does have that hump now. That, you know, we call it a hump now to not hurt his feelings. That's the story of the camel and the hump.
I like that detail that the only reason we don't call it a hump is because we're sensitive to the camel's feelings.
Yeah. We're, you know, we don't want to be sensitive people. I guess I can get on board with that more, with that moral. We should, you know, we should be a little more sensitive.
The hump joke is really funny to me. Like that is the sort of thing a dad would come up with telling a story to his daughter, and I really enjoy it. I do. It did make me wonder how this story gets translated into other languages.
That's good. Yeah, good question. You know, translators are really good at that, though. As you well know, being a translator yourself.
Yeah. As I know, I didn't translate anything that had any particularly difficult wordplay, I'm glad to say.
There's no onomatopoeia in Thirst?
No, it's a pretty dry play, ironically. So a thing to point out about this that we'll see again as we keep going through these is that, again, Kipling has this reputation as a great British imperialist. I haven't read the rest of his work, so I don't know how accurate that is. But he typically takes folklore and culture from the areas that these stories would be set in order to fill in the story. So, like, the fact that it's a djinn, for example, you know, it's taking place in the desert of Saudi Arabia, and so it makes total sense that there would be a djinn involved. And we'll see it again in the next one with the Parsi, and it's just over and over again. These aren't all white British guys. There's a kind of multicultural quality to the Just So stories that I, again, is something that surprised me knowing nothing about Kipling but his reputation when I first read the book.
Yeah. I'll say that that part was a little less surprising to me because, you know, even if you're an Imperial British guy in the at the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, you know, as much as that reputation is, I do feel like there's something about world travel that just, you know, changes you as a person. And so I feel like the fact that I think he was born in India. Is that right? Or
I think he might have been. Yeah.
I know he spent his childhood away from his parents in England and then went back to India at some point to work at a newspaper there or something. Anyway, I think that, you know, just having that as part of your childhood, having that as part of being a young man and traveling the world in that way, I feel like the multicultural stuff didn't surprise me as much. And I think it's really, it's part of what makes the story so appealing.
Yeah. And when it again makes them feel less like they're just the product of one man. Like, I think if you had told me that these were retellings of myths from particular parts of the world, I would probably believe you. I mean, yeah, not as far as I know. As far as I know, made them up. But he made them up in such a way that it feels like it's coming from beyond just him.
Right. Yeah, Kipling definitely had the advantage over his audience in the fact that he had traveled to many places and they had not. And it was before times when information about those places was, you know, kind of few and hard to come by, you know. And so he could kind of put one over on you pretty easily, I think. I don't know how often he did, but I think he did have that advantage.
But the this, moral's this not particular... too hard to figure out in this one.
Yeah. Yeah. Do your work. I did I appreciated this one better, more than the whale, how the whale got his throat. I feel like this is a good one about not, you know, idle hands or the devil's playground or whatever, you know. I feel like that's it's good not to be idle.
Well, and then it gives you the reason for that, which is that if you're idle, somebody else is going to be having to do your work. So you actually see the results of the camel refusing to do anything, which is the other three animals have to work all the harder.
Right. Yeah. So it's despite our first story of the kind of independent, you know, self-reliant person. And in this case, it really shows the interdependence that we all have on each other, which is nice.
Yeah. And then I love the detail that one of the reasons the camel doesn't want to work is he's too busy looking at his reflection in a puddle of water.
Oh yeah. I skipped over that detail, but I shouldn't have, because you're right. That is really, that is really lovely.
An animal as beautiful as a camel.
That's right. Camels are, they're beautiful in their own way.
Probably to other camels. I imagine other camels find one another attractive. I'm not sure I need to look at one.
I kind of like all animals with the big eyes. You know, there's just something about them that just, it makes me, you know, whether it's a camel or a cow and, you know, an ostrich. I just the big eye just gets me. It's like, man, what's going on behind behind that, you know?
He has picked some fairly goofy looking animals. I guess that's not universally true, because the leopard is you know, that's a sleek, beautiful animal.
Yeah.
But he has mostly picked animals that have weird features.
Yeah, which makes sense for the style of myth making that he's doing, right? Because it's the weird features that make you think, well, why is it that way? You
know, that's true.
Why does that animal have that? So
that's true. Although the one I'm looking forward to, the best one in my opinion, is the cat one, which we'll talk about next time. That's not that won't be this month.
Yeah,
cats, of course, not. They don't look weird at all.
They're lovely creatures. Should we talk about how the rhinoceros got its skin?
Yeah, let's do it. So rhinoceros skin, as our listeners will be well aware, is saggy and baggy, but it wasn't always that way. Once upon a time, on an island in the Red Sea, there was a Parsi, and Parsis are descendants of Iranians who live on the Indian subcontinent, I believe. So anyway, this Parsi lives there, and he has a cooking stove and a knife and a hat. And he makes himself a cake one day, and he puts it on the stove to cool. And just as he is going back to eat it, he finds out that a rhinoceros, who has no manners whatsoever, comes in and knocks the stove over and eats the cake and walks away feeling very happy indeed. And the Parsi swears revenge on the rhinoceros. And so 5 weeks later, there's a big heat wave and everybody has to take off their clothes to stay cool. And the rhinoceros takes off his entire skin so that he can come down to the Red Sea and bathe. And the Parsi comes by and finds the skin, and he figures out how to get his revenge on the rhinoceros, which is that he fills it with cake crumbs, which he has a bunch of because cake is the only thing he eats and he's not a very tidy person. So he takes the rhinoceros's skin, which again he's taken off his body, and fills it full of those cake crumbs, and he waits for the rhinoceros to come put it on. And when the rhinoceros puts his skin back on, it's really terrible for him. He just absolutely cannot get comfortable with this. And so he scratches and scratches and scratches. But of course, he can't do anything because the crumbs are inside his skin. So there's no way to scratch them off. And from that day on, the rhinoceros has had very saggy, baggy skin, and also he's always in a really bad mood. So the moral of the story is don't eat other people's cakes. I guess.
A little less clear on this one. Yeah. Yeah, but you should not. You should not not eat other people's cakes.
And you should never touch the stove. He's very clear that Effie should not be touching stoves.
Yeah, that's right. That's yeah, I guess that's the real moral, maybe. I don't know. This one's a little more inscrutable in that way, I guess. But it is a very funny funny story about taking revenge on someone. So.
And it's got the, you know, the kind of indelible image of the rhinoceros taking his skin off when it gets hot, and the Parsi filling it full of crumbs.
Yeah, it's a very ironic punishment, I guess. You know, since he took the cake and now he's being punished by the cake. So, a little bit of what goes around comes around, I suppose.
Oh, what's that called? There's a term for this, contra passo.
And what does that mean?
Counter punishment, I think, or counter pass. It's what happens to you in Dante's Inferno, where whatever you're, you have okay. An ironic punishment based on your sin.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So yeah, that's good. I'm glad that gives this story even a little more weight, I guess. You know, it's a little Dante. Anytime you can drop Dante in there, it just feels a little more weighty. So.
I feel like, and this is this, maybe I'm wrong about this. I feel like these stories bear less scrutiny than the Grimm's fairy tales do. I just feel like we have less to say about them than we had to say about all those Grimm stories. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think I think you're right. I think there's something about the, if I had to take a guess at why that is, I think these are just, they're very straightforward. And the Grimm's, I feel like that we talked the most about. I haven't gone back to actually listen and figure this out, but it seems like we were often trying to like parse the story in some way, you know, like what's actually going on here and what's this mean and you know, just make a little sense of it. Whereas these ones, they kind of make sense of themselves. Like they're meant to make sense of themselves.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think these are less inscrutable. And it's not that they're less fun to read. In some ways, they're more fun to read because they do a lot of the work of interpretation for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, this is what I wanted, right? I mean, when we talked about the Grimms, I said next time I want to do something that one person wrote, so that you don't have all these weird textual layers that you can feel but can't see when you're reading the text.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean, I think, that there's less to say about them. Like it's so much more straightforward. That was the term you used. It's the right term. It does not require us to kind of pick through it the way some of the weirder Grimm stories required that of us.
Yeah.
Like I feel like our episodes on Kipling are going to be much shorter than our Grimm's episodes.
Yeah, which is okay.
Yeah, it's fun.
They are fun to read and they're fun to retell. And if anyone listening has not read them, I encourage you to pick them up because they are part of what we lose in the retelling is Kipling is masterful with his language. And there's a lot of the one thing I was reading about him was just how much energy comes through in his writing, which I think is right. There's a lot of energy in the stories. And so I would encourage people to go read them.
Yeah, probably more energy than we're giving them in our retelling.
Yeah. Yeah, the image of the rhinoceros without his skin is a little disturbing, honestly. It's like, well, what's underneath there? But he treats it like it's clothes, you know, like everybody right. Take off their clothes.
And in the cartoon fashion, right? Like clothes. That's a yeah. That's a thing that happens in a lot of cartoons.
That's right. You take off your clothes and there's another layer underneath, you know. Yeah, I'm thinking of the newer Mickey Mouses. They're not as new anymore. They've been around for a decade now, but the Paul Rudish, I think is the creator director's name on those new Mickey Mouses. And there's one episode where Minnie like puts on a black shirt and, like it just goes on and it just, you know, Minnie obviously is just, you know, just it makes no difference whatsoever, you know. And so it's little jokes like that that are very funny, very cartoony. And this one, there's a little bit of the fairy tale nature in this, because I feel like in a lot of the fairy tales, different creatures were able to take off their skins, you know, or you know, like what My Dear Little Hedgehog and there was another one too where Hans my Hedgehog. Yeah, Hans my Hedgehog took off his hedgehog skin, and there's another one where the guy took off his skin and they threw it in the fire, and then he became a prince. I don't remember what that was either, but yeah. There's a little bit of that. A little bit
never
of
played for laughs, though, or very rarely played for laughs.
That's true. It's different. Yeah, you're right. That's another thing.
I just those Grimm stories, most of them did not have a lot of stuff that instantly read as humor. Whereas this
that's
definitely
right.
You can feel him trying to make his daughter laugh.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And I think you said in one of our last episodes, you know, you said, I think it was with King Ironhead, you were like, never has the value, what'd you say, the values of the Grimms and our values been so far or so dissonant or something like that. I don't know. You said it very, very nicely and I'm butchering it. But like, I think probably Kipling's just that much more closer to our own value system. Because like you have to kind of share a value system to share a humor system.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So there may have been stuff that was meant to be very, very funny in the Grimms, and it just passed over us because we didn't share the same values. Not that we didn't have any of the same values, but you know what I mean. I just feel like we're probably much closer to Kipling than we are to the Grimm brothers.
Be careful, Josh. You're going to get us canceled.
I'm not saying that we're exactly the same as Kipling. I'm sure there are some things that Kipling and I would greatly disagree on. So.
Well, why don't you tell us how the leopard got his spots?
All right. Let's see. How did the leopard get his spots? So the leopard lived in the high veldt. And you must remember that it wasn't the low veldt or the bush veldt or the sour veldt, but the exclusively bare, hot, shiny, high veldt. And he lived up there with the giraffe and the zebra and the eland, the kudu, the hartebeest. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And the leopard was the exclusivest, sandiest, yellowest, brownest of them all. And he would go hunting, and he would hunt with an Ethiopian. And they would hunt up there together, and they hunted the giraffe, and they hunted the zebra and all these other animals. And the other animals kind of got tired of being hunted all the time. And so they took off. They left the high veldt, and they went down and they hid in the great forest. And the great forest was full of trees and bushes and shadows. And standing in the shade all the time with the light kind of half on them, half off, it kind of gave them their markings that we're familiar with now. And meanwhile, the leopard and the Ethiopian were getting hungrier and hungrier and wondering where all their meals went. And so they went to the wisest animal of all, who is Bavian, the dog-headed barking baboon. And he says to them that they must change themselves. And he says, this is quite funny, so I'm just going to read it straight from here. The Ethiopian says to the Bavian, "Can you tell me the present habitat of the Aboriginal fauna?" And then it says in parentheses, that meant just the same thing as what the leopard said, which is, where is all the game gone? But the Ethiopian always used long words because he was a grown up. So anyway, the Bavian tells them that they have to change themselves and go and down into the forest. And so they go down to the forest, but when they get down there, all the other animals are now camouflaged because they've been hanging out in the forest. And meanwhile, the Ethiopian and the leopard are not camouflaged at all. They stand out. There's a couple good lines in here too. He says, he says, "You show up in this dark place like a mustard plaster on a sack of coals." That was pretty good. So anyway, the leopard is hesitant. He doesn't want to change, but what they do is they catch the zebra and the giraffe in the nighttime, but they don't know for sure if it's the zebra and the giraffe because they can't see them. So they wait until the morning. And then when they see them, the zebra now has stripes and this giraffe now has the spots the giraffes are known to have. And they say, how did you get these? And then the animals say, well, we'll show you. And if you let us go. And so they stand up and then they say, 1, 2, 3, where's your breakfast? And they disappear into the shadows again. And so the leopard and the Ethiopian realize that they also have to change if they're going to be able to hunt these animals and catch them. And so so they do that. The Ethiopian decides to make himself into a nice working blackish brownish color with a little purple in it and touches of slaty blue. And it will be the very thing for hiding in hollows and behind the trees. So he changes his skin to that way. And he has a little left over on the tips of his fingers. And so he presses into the leopard the tips of his fingers. And that's why if you look at the leopard spots, you see little clusters of five, and it says sometimes it got a little smudged, but for the most part it's clusters of five. And so then they were able to hide in the forest the same as the other animals and lie right out on the bare ground and look like pebbles. And and so then they're able to live happily ever after because they can catch their lunch and their breakfast again. And the moral on this one I thought was very interesting, because it says, now and then you'll hear grown-ups say, can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? And I don't think even grown-ups would keep on saying such a silly thing if the leopard and the Ethiopian hadn't done it once, do you? But they will never do it again, best beloved. They are quite contented as they are.
You know what's interesting about this one is it's true. I mean, kind of.
What do you mean?
That is, you know, if evolutionary theory is correct, this is how the leopard got his spots, kind of, that he has them because it allows him to camouflage himself in his hunting territory. And, you know, it wasn't that one leopard asked one Ethiopian to paint him, but that is why the leopard has spots. It just takes place over generations, presumably, as opposed to happening just once. But it's interesting how close to, which I'm sure Kipling would have known, how close to the scientific truth this got.
Yeah, I had that a little bit in mind too when I was reading these stories, particularly this one, was, you know, he's obviously pulling from a tradition of all these different kind of these tales, you know, of how different things came to be, you know, how the possum got his tail, or how the wolf got his howl, or, you know, like all these types of mythical stories that he is writing in a post Darwinian time, you know. And so it is interesting to me, like how much he's maybe adapting the style of story or not adapting it, you know. I was watching an interview with Dana Goya. Is that how you say his name?
Joya.
The poet? Joya, yeah. And I'm really good at pronouncing names, you know, I'm just like professional. Dana Joya, he said a great poem, the poet is kind of having an argument with themselves. And I thought of that as I read these. It's like, he's not easy to pin down on, like, is he being ridiculous? Does he think the evolutionary stuff is somewhat ridiculous? Does he think the evolutionary stuff is really right? But and he's just being silly for being the sake of being silly. And there's a little bit of back and forth maybe in the deep subtext, and maybe that's part of like what makes these stories so timeless and classic. Also, you know.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I think, yeah, the adaptation of different animals to their environments is definitely something that was, you know, definitely on the minds of people in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So it does read a little evolutionary, but not at the same time, because that's what I mean, I guess, like the giraffe and the zebra, it's very scientifically natural. I mean, not, you know, not that they're getting a suntan through the leaves. I guess that part's not very scientific. But you know what I mean? Like it's all natural processes. It's all natural processes, I guess I should say. Whereas the Ethiopian changes his skin basically by magic and then uses the leftovers on the leopard.
Right. Man is apart from these natural processes. He has transcended them.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think was one of the main things that, like, or continues to be one of the main things, really, you know, for people who are non-Darwinians, you know, it's like, well, it doesn't make sense that man would come out of that. You know, man is a separate, you know, whether it's created in the image of God or whether it's just, I didn't come from a monkey, you know, like, well, you know, but however you want to put it, like, I think that man set apart outside of the natural processes could definitely be on in especially a stiff upper-lipped Englishman's mind, you know. I think there probably was a little bit of an inner argument for everybody encountering this theory for the first time. It's like, oh man, what's the you know, what exactly, how exactly do we apply this into our own lives? So
Yeah, and I have no idea what his relationship to science was or anything like that.
Oh yeah, I don't either. I just meant that, you know, it just seems natural.
Yeah, and obviously he's playing so much of it for comedy. Anyway, right. What do you make? So you hear that this is going to be about a Ethiopian dyeing himself black, and maybe you get a little nervous. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What did you think of his treatment of the Ethiopian? Did you think there was anything negative in it?
Well, I mean, there's one moment. I'm not going to read it word for word here because it's not a word that I would use. But yeah, there's one moment where he says that plain black is the best for Ethiopians in the end, you know. And I don't know if that was a slight or not. It's hard to tell, you know. It's hard to read with Edwardian, you know, late Victorian, early Edwardian glasses on these things because I'm not either of those things, you know. So it's hard to know exactly how. But certainly he doesn't seem. You know, he uses big words. He doesn't, and it doesn't. I don't know. Is that played for laughs, or is that just like he said? It's just because he's a grown up, you know, and grown ups use right. big words. You know,
yeah, that,
like
that's is not he just, because is he's an Ethiopian. It's because he's a human.
Yeah,
so he's full of himself.
Right. But it doesn't seem to be like he's putting on airs or something, like he's trying to be more than he is. And it doesn't seem like he's an idiot either, you know, like he takes the advice. The leopard's not going to take the advice, but he is, you know. So I think that there's a lot of good to say for him, for sure. I don't know if it made me completely comfortable or not.
Yeah. But, and they even the description of his skin makes it sound beautiful. It's not... It's not a simplistic and certainly not a negative description. He says he's changing it to a nice working blackish brownish color with a little purple in it and touches of slaty blue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, not what I would have expected.
Yeah. He definitely keeps you on your toes in that way. It's not. Yeah, I agree. Not what you'd expect. So I've heard the can the leopard change his spots. I think the can the Ethiopian change his skin has dropped out of the
idiom. Don't think people say that anymore. In Shakespeare's day, the expression was you can't bathe in Ethiope.
Oh, okay.
Which people don't say anymore for some reason.
Self-evident reasons. I like the idea that before he changed his skin, he was yellow. Like he was like a Simpson character, apparently.
Yeah, he was the same color as the leopard.
Yeah.
Best friends.
I they have fun little relationship.
Yeah, they do, and it's funny because they're like they're the apex predators, and they're buddies.
Yeah.
Feared by all the other animals except the dog-headed baboon, the wisest animal in all of Africa.
Yeah. Rafiki.
Yeah, I wondered if the presentation of Rafiki in The Lion King had something to do with the... Bavian, is that his name?
Yeah, that's the way I said it. I don't know if that's the right way to say it. As you'll recall, I just mispronounced Dana Joya's name.
I think Dana Joya has a name that a lot of people mispronounce, Josh. I don't think the pronunciation of that name is obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
Well, let's look at the...
Right.
No, go please. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, it's again, it's one of those things where it's hard to know where he's drawing on, things and where he's making them up, you know? So like, is he drawing on, you know, African folk tales that he's heard in his travels about the wise baboons, or is he just making it up? And then because he made it up, then, you know, Disney's also using it in The Lion King, or are they both drawing from some older source? You know, it's hard to know.
Maybe we should have done actual African folk tales.
That would be fun to do at some point.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. No, absolutely. That wasn't a joke. I when we get around to those, it'll be interesting to look back and see if we see any parallels to how the leopard got his spots.
Yeah. Just as long as people keep remembering that we're here just full of wonder and not information, then it's totally fine. Because we're just wondering about this stuff. I don't know anything about it. So, all right, Elephant's Child. This is a really fun one too.
Yeah, this is a fun one. So the Elephant's Child is an elephant child. And at the time period we're talking about, elephants, children, and adults alike don't have the long, ridiculous noses that we know them to have. And instead, they have a blackish, bulgy nose as big as a boot that they can kind of move back and forth, but certainly it's not prehensile and it doesn't do anything cool like real elephants' trunks do. Well, this elephant child was very curious, and every time he asked a question, one of his relatives would beat him for asking the question. And it goes through all his different relatives. It's basically every animal in Africa is his relative in one way or another. But one day he decides to ask the question, what does the crocodile have for dinner? And they beat him for a really long time for asking that one, I guess because it's dangerous to be around crocodiles. I'm not really sure. Nobody ever explains why they're hitting them. It seems like they could just say, don't ask questions about crocodiles because crocodiles will eat you, but they don't do that. So instead, he wanders off into the forest and he meets the Kolo Kolo bird. And the Kolo Kolo bird tells him that if he wants to find out what crocodiles have for dinner, he just needs to go to the Limpopo River, which is surrounded by fever trees, and he'll find it out there. So he walks apparently all the way across South Africa looking for the Limpopo River, and he's eating melons the whole way and leaving the melon rinds just laying around. But finally, he comes across a python, and he asks the python if the python has seen any crocodiles. And the python says more or less, of course. And then the elephant's child asks him if he can tell him what crocodiles eat for dinner. And the python, like everybody else, starts to spank him for it. So he keeps moving, and eventually he finds what he thinks is a log of wood floating in the Limpopo River. And he steps on it, except that it's not a log. It is, of course, the crocodile. And he and the crocodile get into a conversation about what crocodiles eat. And the crocodile reveals himself to the elephant's child to be the crocodile and tells him to come closer, at which point the crocodile bites him on the nose and won't let go. And the python tells him that if he wants to survive this encounter, he'd better pull back as hard as he possibly can. And so he does, and he keeps pulling, and the crocodile keeps pulling. And the python ties himself in a knot around the elephant's child and helps him pull. And they pull, and they pull, and they pull. And of course, at the end of the story, the elephant's trunk has become an actual trunk and not just a boot-shaped thing that he can move around. And the elephant's child is not terribly happy about this at first because he's got such a long nose now. And then the python tells him that actually, if he thinks about it, his nose would be very good to spank people with. And the elephant's child says, won't it be nice to go home and give everybody what for after the way they treated me before? And that's pretty much exactly what he does. He walks back to his house, and on the way, he finds all sorts of uses for his trunk. So he's able to pull fruit down from trees. He's able to pull grass up from the ground. He's able to swat flies. He's able to splash mud all over himself. And indeed, when he gets home, he's able to spank his relatives with his trunk, instead of allowing them to spank him. And after that, none of the elephants spanked anybody anymore. And going from that point on, all elephants have ridiculous noses like the elephant's child.
Yeah, I think the doesn't it say that the other family members went down and got their own noses from the crocodile also? So
yes,
you get the impression that they all went through this this bit of trial and tribulation. So
yes, that's right. So like the crocodile is responsible. You know, you'd think he'd catch on at some point and bite the elephants somewhere else if what he's trying to do is eat the elephants.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. That's true. I liked so on his way down to meet the crocodile, he's eating these melons and he's leaving the rinds all over the place because he can't pick them up.
Right, because he doesn't have a trunk yet.
Yeah, but on his way back it says the rest of the time he picked up the melon rinds that he had dropped on his way down to the Limpopo, for he was a very tidy pachyderm.
it's an important thing for him to do. He's not like the Parsi in that way.
That's right. That's good. I think this one, there's a little pushback against the, children should be seen but not heard. You know, it's kind of that, most of my knowledge of Edwardian England comes from Mary Poppins. But, you know, you get that, like, you know, Mr. Banks in the beginning, he wants to, you know, just basically see his children, pat him on the head, send him off to bed, and they shouldn't be making a lot of noise or asking a lot of questions or anything. And, you know, you kind of get that impression with, you know, this elephant. It's like the elephant child is not meant to be asking any questions. And that's every time he does, that's why he's getting spanked all the time. But the moral is kind of counter to it, because, you know, in the end, the baby elephant, because of all the questions, ends up really learning, not just learning, but growing and developing this, you know, something of advantage.
That the other elephants envy him for.
Yeah, and end up going and getting themselves. So there seems to be a little bit of an undercut on this one, as far as, you know, what maybe he's teaching his own daughter is it's okay, you know, it's okay to ask a lot of questions.
Well, and he essentially gets a new technology, right? Like that's the way it's described on his way home. All these new things he's able to do with it, and so it's like, inadvertently, anyway, his curiosity has led him to make this technological advance.
Right. I didn't think about it in technological terms, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Which, of course, is another thing that's, you know, kind of happening at this point in world history with the Industrial Revolution and all that. You know, all this, you know, new things are coming into being. So.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
That's good insight. I didn't think about that at all. Thinking of it as a technology is I think a great way to think of it.
And we've all got the moral that you need to be careful beating children, because eventually they'll come back and beat you.
Yeah, I guess that's true too.
He pulled out his tall ostrich aunt's tail feathers and he caught his tall uncle the giraffe by the hind leg and dragged him through a thorn bush. Shouted his broad aunt, the hippopotamus, and blew bubbles into her ear when she was sleeping in the water after meals. He really goes after him.
He does.
But he protects the Colo Colo bird.
That's right, because the Colo Colo bird, the Colo Colo bird did something for him, didn't he?
He told him how to find the crocodile.
Oh, that's right, yeah. So not so dissimilar in some ways from the from our rhinoceros story. You know, it's that you know, there's definitely some sort of sense of like childlike justice in these stories. I feel like whether it's true justice or not, it could be debatable, but there's definitely a childlike sort of justice in these stories.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think children's stories kind of have to have justice in them. I think children are probably less willing to accept an unjust ending than adults are.
Yes, I think that's true.
Well, we just got the one left, Josh.
Yep. All right. Let's wrap her up. So this is the Sing Song of Old Man Kangaroo. And this one, the kangaroo did not always look the way that we think of the kangaroo now, but was a much different animal with four short legs. He was gray and he was woolly and his pride was inordinate. And he danced on an outcrop in the middle of the Australia. And he visits three little gods, or I guess three gods. He goes to little god, Nkua. Was that? I'm just gonna make it up. I'm gonna speak boldly, like I know what I'm talking about. So he goes to little god Nkua, and he says, "Make me different from all the other animals by 5 o'clock this afternoon." And then he moves on. That little god says, "Go away," and he moves on to the middle god, which is called Nkuing. And he goes to Nkuing, and he says the same thing: "Make me different from all the other animals. Make me also wonderfully popular by 5 this afternoon." And Qing says, "Go away." And then he goes to the big god, Nkong. And when he gets to Nkong, he says, "Make me different from all other animals. Make me popular and wonderfully run after by 5 this afternoon." And so Nkong says, "Yeah, I will do that." And he calls up the yellow dog, Dingo, who's always hungry and dusty in the sunshine. And he says to the dingo, "I want you to go chase this kangaroo around." And so the dingo begins chasing the kangaroo, and the kangaroo begins running and running. And the longer he runs, the stronger his legs get. And then at one point, as he is running, he comes to the Wollongong River. And there's no bridge, and there's no ferry boat, and the kangaroo doesn't know how to get over. So he stands up on his legs, and he hops because he had to. And he begins hopping, and as he's hopping, his legs are growing longer and stronger, and he has no time to stop or rest. And the dingo has no time to stop or rest. He just continues chasing him. And it says the kangaroo hopped like a cricket, like a pea in a saucepan, or a new rubber ball on the nursery floor. And he runs all around, and finally, they end up back very tired at the old god Nkong. And they get there, and he says, "It's 5 o'clock," and the dingo sits down and kind of, you know, is panting like dogs do. And the kangaroo sits down, and he says, "Man, thank goodness that's finished." And he says, Nkong says, "You need to be grateful to that yellow dog dingo because of all he's done for you." And so then the kangaroo says, "Well, he's chased me out of the homes of my childhood, and he's chased me out of my regular meal times, and he's altered my shape, so I'll never get it back." And Nkong says, "Perhaps I'm mistaken, but didn't you ask me to make you different from all the other animals?" And now it's 5 o'clock, and so the kangaroo realizes, yes, you did that. But the dog is not very happy with this situation because he says, "Well, I did all the work. what do I get?" And the god says, "Well, just come and ask me about it tomorrow." And so both the old man kangaroo and the yellow dog dingo look at each other and say, "This is all your fault." And that's it.
Which is a very funny ending. Like, the timing on the ending is very funny.
Yeah, this would be again one that if I was Rudyard himself telling it as a bedtime story, I'm sure it would have been better. So
that's your fault. Yeah, they're like in the middle of Australia where there's nothing.
Right.
I liked this one. This one you have, we talked a lot about tricksters when we read Grimm's. This one you have like almost a trickster god, where the kangaroo has asked him for something and the god gives it to him, but he gives it to him in not at all the way he expected, but in a more appropriate and just way. So that's a fun aspect of the story to me.
Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't just magic him into this new thing, you know, but again, there's a little bit of the evolutionary or the natural sort of way of things, you know, implied in the story, you know,
he had to learn to jump to get away from the dingo.
Right. Yeah. And the ones that could jump got away. And so, you know, then they were able to have, you know, to reproduce and then, you know, but of course, in this case, it's all just one fast story. So
I feel like Kipling could have written an entire book just about crazy animals in Australia.
There are a lot of crazy animals in Australia. It's true. That's a wild place down there.
Have you ever seen a kangaroo?
I've seen wallaroos, which is like the smaller ones. I don't think I've ever seen a full-sized kangaroo, I don't believe.
I was at a petting zoo once and they had them, and you could touch them, and it is the softest animal I have ever touched.
Really?
Yeah, you would never think that. And then also at that same petting zoo, a kangaroo gave birth to a baby kangaroo in front of a god and everybody. Which, wow. I did not watch that part.
Wow.
The miracle of life discussed. The
miracle of life discussed. Well, it's really amazing. Well, yeah. Those marsupials, you know, the babies are born and then they just crawl into the pouch and then continue kind of gestating in there. So it's kind of amazing.
The Joey. Do kangaroos seem like proud animals to you?
Yeah, maybe, I guess. I don't know. They're always in the cartoons, which it seems to be my only source of knowledge is cartoons. They're always boxing, I guess. I don't know about proud necessarily. I don't know. Do they seem proud to you?
No. The boxing thing is real, you know. Like, that was a thing that they box. Have you ever seen kangaroos fight each other?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I have seen that. Well, I mean, I'm not in person, obviously.
Yeah. 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 You've seen videos.
Yeah. They do have that kind of that long nose, and they do kind of hold it a little snooty high in the air, I guess, you know. So I guess you could see it. What's the kangaroo-ish character in Horton? Whatever her name is, she's definitely very prideful.
So maybe there is a thing. I remember that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you gotta brush up on your Dr. Seuss, Michael.
I never really liked Dr. Seuss.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You don't have to apologize for your bad opinions.
It probably is a bad opinion. And you know, not having kids, I never needed to read it again, so right. I never returned to Dr. Seuss. But I liked the cartoon, the How the Grinch Stole Christmas cartoon, like everybody else did, mostly for the song. And I think I remember reading Horton Hears a Who when I was a kid, but like I don't have any particular attachment to Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, that's okay. Like
everybody else I know.
There's one in every crowd, you know.
I'm sorry.
Oh, well, anyway, we don't need to get on that subject. I guess
we really just have not had as much to say about these as we did about the Grimms, and I apologize to our listeners for that.
Yeah, I feel like we did pretty well. I think we've kind of fizzled here at the end, but I you're right. It's not the same at all, and we're kind of finding our way. And so it'll be interesting next episode if we're a little more, you know, having gone through it once, if we have a little more to say.
See, they don't bear the kind of scrutiny that like a great novel bears, where you can have a long aesthetic discussion about them. But they also don't bear the kind of scrutiny that the Grimms bear, where they're so rich because they're like collective subconscious bubbling above the forest floor. They're somewhere in the middle. These things that are written specifically for children. I'm gonna have to give some thought to that and think about like what a better way to approach them next month will be. We do have one that I think is pretty amazing, next month, The Cat That Walked by Himself. But yeah. All of them really are like, if our listeners for whatever reason did not read these, they should go read them. They will take you almost no time at all, and they're very charming.
Yeah. When did you? I wonder, based on what you're saying here about, you know, how should we approach them? When did you first encounter these stories?
Last summer.
Okay. See, same for me. Like I was kind of vaguely aware of them, but this is the first time I've ever really sat down and read them. We had the book, you know, I picked it up at a thrift store or something. And I was like, oh, I should get that. But like had kind of flipped through it after I read your article in the Front Porch Republic. I went back and read the one about the cat, but this is my first time like really encountering them. And I wonder, like you said, there's certain things, certain literary things that bear scrutiny, and then there's others that don't. And I feel like maybe if it's an others that don't, then you have to be like, have some sort of nostalgia for it, or be like a super fan or something, and then you'd have more to say.
But or like maybe if one of us was super knowledgeable about Rudyard Kipling.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Then there'd be more, perhaps, you know, to say about it, but just kind of encountering them. They're lovely stories, and they're fun, and they're fun to retell. And, yeah. But they're, like you said, there's just not a ton to say about them beyond
the
retail.
They definitely don't have the magic that the actual folktales have.
Right. Yeah. There's magic in them, but they're not magical themselves. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. 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 You don't feel that there's more to them than you can understand. Or that's how I don't feel that way anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is kind of the way I feel about a lot of the actual, I mean, I'm not super familiar with a ton of them, but the mythology that he's kind of drawing upon, how did this thing come to be? I kind of feel the same about all of them, I guess. I don't have that strong feeling of like, oh, this is a really wonderful magical tale. But I wonder if there is a comparison, like the ones that are a little more rooted, I guess, or natural, or like they started in some sort of oral tradition versus the ones that he's just telling here and writing down, if you would get that feeling of magic from them, or if it's just the genre itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's weird that like Disney never did anything with these. You would think there would at least be some silly symphonies or something that were based on these stories, because they would be very, very easy to very, very easy to adapt. It's weird that they never did it.
That's true. Yeah. I think especially the elephant one for sure. You know, Elephant's Child. Like you can imagine very easily that nose stretching out. You know, there's so many other cartoony things like that where things are being pulled and getting stretched, you know, out of shape. So I don't know. I guess they'd already done Dumbo. So
just so.
I feel like the Disney of today would do it. Like not, like I feel like there's so many ancillary creations around each creation. Like if they were coming out with the Jungle Book next year, you know, then there'd be like a whole series of shorts of just those stories also to like,
oh, interesting,
to promote it or whatever, you know, perhaps. Or maybe if Pixar was doing it more than Disney. Pixar seems like the one that they have, like, you know, they've got like so many shorts with the, you know, like all the Toy Story shorts and all the, I don't know. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Have you seen the commercials for the new Snow White yet?
I haven't. No, I've been fortunate to avoid those, I guess.
It looks awful. I mean, I'll never know. but it looks bad.
Yeah.
Anytime somebody's like, you should see one of these live action, a student or something, you should see one of these live action ones, I always say, oh, I'm sorry, not allowed. Podcast is called Before They Were Live.
That's right. Yeah. somebody else could do that podcast after they were live.
All right. Well, next month we'll finish up these Just Those stories. Just out of curiosity, do you have the 13th story, Josh, in your collection? Mine doesn't have it.
Oh, I did not even know there was a 13th story.
It's about taboo.
No, I've only got six more.
Okay. Yeah. So we won't be doing the taboo story.
Okay. All right.
The taboo tale. That's what it's called.
The taboo tale. It's taboo for our podcast also.
That's true. So we'll do beginning of the armadillos, how the first letter was written, how the alphabet was made, the crab that played with the sea, the cat that walked by himself, and the butterfly that stamped.
All right. Sounds good. I look forward to it. And I hope you look forward to it too. Let's see. Do I have an ending? I almost forgot what I was doing here. Sorry. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipek. We're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. And you can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network. For mostly all old shows now, we're kind of last man standing. I think is Christian Humanist Profiles still going?
Goes. Yep. Still goes. And I think. Well, I mean, City of Man. I think Gilmore and Coyle are still doing those from time to time.
Yeah, it's always fun when they come out with one. I always, yeah. So you know, there's stuff around people.
But it's mostly just us, and you know, 5,000 back episodes of all of those shows.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Go to the back episodes. So anyway, we know there's a great number of other podcasts out there you could be spending your time on. So thank you for wasting your time with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altman Schoeffer, and that's your fault.